everyone. Today is October 13th, 2019, and this is episode 201 of At Percussion. I'm Carly Vigna, and with me today are co-host Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, everybody.
And Ben Charles.
Hi, everybody.
It's Halloween, right? Like, am I the only one?
I thought that's just how you normally dress.
No, it's Halloween. We're releasing a Halloween. You guys got to pay attention to the calendar. I even have this. I have others too, Ben.
Now we're getting ripped off YouTube for copyright infringement.
I think it's short enough. I think we won't.
Let's test it out.
Well, since this is Thad's first time on the podcast, as far as he's concerned, Casey always looks like this.
Right. That's what I thought this was.
It's just what he does on Sundays.
It's what the people want. You have to get views. You have to get downloads.
Right. Well, now this is incentive for people that normally listen just audio. You got to check out the video and see what we're talking about.
There is more that goes on in the video. It's true. Sometimes there's music examples or, yeah, important stuff like this.
You can see some instruments. Well, without further ado, our guest today is Thad Anderson, who is Associate Professor of Music at the University of Central Florida, where he coordinates the Percussion Studies program, teaches applied lessons, and directs the UCF Percussion Ensemble. Thad also oversees the Collide Contemporary Music Series, directs the UCF New Music Ensemble, and teaches courses in music technology. Thad is a versatile performer and pedagogue with focus interests that involve new music, composition, electro-acoustic music, conducting, and technology. So welcome to the show, Thad. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here with you guys.
Well, I thought we'd start off talking about your recent Northbound project, because I was checking that out on your website, and I just think it's really compelling and fascinating. Would you give us some background on the project?
Yeah. So we're fortunate here in Orlando to have a really great burgeoning artistic scene, and there's a number of key players. So there was a project here in town called the Transit Interpretation Project. It was part of a larger collective called the Corridor Project. And there were two iterations of months where they asked artists, visual artists, writers, poets, composers, musicians, to ride public transportation and create some sort of artwork. Some people did performances on our city buses, and some people created photography and visual art. And I decided to board our brand new, at the time, commuter rail line that goes through downtown Orlando called SunRail. This is back in, I think, 2015. So this is a few years ago. But decided to board the train and ride the 12 stops or 11 stops. I was at the southernmost station. Rode all 12 stations, and I brought a mic with me and I recorded the entire trip, which took about a little over an hour long. So it's like an hour and 2 minutes. Recorded the field recording, grabbed that, and that determined the structure for this piece that I was going to create. And really, at the time, I had no idea what was going to happen with it, what was going to come of it. I knew I was going to take the field recording. I made markers in my digital audio workstation as we were going north. Took some notes and ended up creating 11 movements of music for each of the portions of the trip where you're moving from station to station. Took those 11 movements, broke them down into three different types of movements, ones that would involve definite pitched instruments, ones that would involve indefinite pitched instruments, and then ones that would involve all of them. There's a prelude, there's a postlude, and then there's six movements that have an electronic playback component that was pre-composed. And then three of the movements are just live percussion. And as far as the performance is concerned, it involves the field recording, what was happening on the train that day, and the electronic playback, the pre-composed material. And then, of course, I would do improvised live percussion using what I called my vibra-kit, and just combination of drum set vibraphone. So, yeah, played it a few times, just did a talk on it with Brian Bloom's group down at Southeastern University. So it was on my mind, and it's something I really got a lot out of and really enjoyed. Would love to take on another project like that.
I saw in the notes you have online that you took an omnidirectional mic with you on the train, and kind of a gear question here. What's your favorite portable way to do field recordings? There are so many, and I don't know, just wondering what you like to do. And when I was listening, I thought, like, oh, it's so clean, and that's always such a concern I have whenever I take my Zoom recorder out or whatever to collect sounds.
You know. Yeah, so the top, this is like a, it's not a light rail, it's an engine. It's a big, like, double decker, it's like Caltrain style train. I was on the upper deck of one of the cars, and they have tables. So I was able to set up with my laptop, and actually it was a Blue Yeti microphone set to the omnidirectional pickup pattern. Uh-huh. And that's what I used to make the field recording. And so, yeah, that was my preferred setup for that day, mostly because it was just low key and pretty small footprint.
I've got a Yeti right here, just barely off camera there. But I've just found with Yetis, it's always louder than everything else. Like I've had situations I can't get it quiet enough.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. This worked just fine for the purposes of the trip, and it's rugged enough to hop on the train. So.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Well, thanks. Thad, we had a Facebook question that sort of relates to this from Ted Jackson. He says, how has technology played a role in your career, composition, performance, etc., and who is your favorite student? And also, before you get to that important question there, I noticed on your UCF like webpage, so to speak, your bio, it says that you teach, I think, a class called Music and Technology or something along those lines.
Yeah. So I've got three different technology courses that I'm teaching, not at the same time. And one of them I teach only fully online now, every off semester. And so let's see. So yeah, I've got a graduate technology course that I'm doing right now. And then I have a technology music education course. Theodore Jackson. it is a great question from him, and obviously Ted is one of my great students, one of many great students.
But who's your favorite?
Yeah.
Who's your one favorite?
He's my one favorite.
He's my favorite listener who asks questions. I'm not afraid to say it. You win, Ted.
Yeah, good. Well, that sounds like Ted. So
he's asked good questions for years.
Yeah, good for Ted. What was the first part of his questions? How have I used technology to?
How has it played a role in your career?
Oh yeah.
And I guess you could also maybe, how did you just get into that? Because it's something, it seems like there's always a gateway.
Oh, absolutely. I never thought I would be teaching music technology, and actually haven't even taken a course in music technology. Or coming up through my undergrad and grad school, was never required to take a music technology course.
It might not have even existed, really. I mean,
no, yeah. I mean, I probably could have taken a MIDI class and would have been very interested to do so. Just wasn't in the cards at the time. But as an undergrad, no, it wasn't an option. Texas, there was probably something I could have pursued. I don't know. Probably something composition wise with technology and electroacoustic music studio. I've always been tinkering with stuff as a kid, and coming up through high school and college, just very interested in technology and early on made it a part of what I did as far as a performer and as a percussionist, and it's always been an integral part of what I do. So teaching the music technology courses was just a perfect fit. And when I got to UCF 10 years ago, there was a need to teach those classes. And so I started teaching the one class that they had offered and at the time, Introduction to Music Technology, and quickly got involved in teaching the other two, which had never been taught before. They were on the books, but they had never been offered the music education course and then the graduate level, which is really an introduction course as well. But it's really the Northbound project's like a perfect example because of the very technology that it uses, but just integrating it into my composing, integrating it into my performing. And I find it interesting and a way to enhance what I love to do. So,
well, to follow up on that, Thad, I'm wondering, what do you think today's percussion students, whether they're going to be educators or performers, need to know about technology? Like what skills should they have?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously basic recording chops, understanding of, the function of a microphone, the difference between a condenser and a dynamic, the ability to record, whether it's on a Zoom or using a Yeti mic or something a little bit more in depth with a digital audio workstation and an audio interface and plugging in that way. So, basic ideas and understanding of mixing, running a mixer. I have my students often sit behind the mixer and I'll rotate them around and just run live front of house sound just to understand, all right, you're going to work with me tonight to get this set up and everything plugged in and you can sit behind the board and make sure everything's balanced and just an understanding there. The web tools that are out there, whether it's building a website or just kind of doing your business and getting yourself out there is huge. So and I think performing with electronics, that's something I want to push all of my students to experiment with and try and support them with and try to help as much as possible. So I feel strongly about that too.
Yeah, of course. And of course, also technology, the tricky thing is it's changing. Like the things that are happening now are so different than, when we were in school. And it's only going to get, more and more different. Hey, congratulations on 10 years at UCF. That's very exciting.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
It sounds like you at least kind of developed a few courses. I'm wondering, how has the position changed during your time there?
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit. I came to UCF in 2009. I should mention though that I came to UCF first in 1999. I did my undergrad with Jeff Moore, music education, and for me, coming back to UCF was coming back home, and never thought I would end up back at UCF. Never in my wildest dreams, finishing up my doctorate at Texas, it just so happened that Jeff was moving into the chairman's position back in 2009, and I was the lucky person at the right place at the right time that got the call and was able to start on a one-year position that turned into a three-year visiting position that turned into a tenure track position eventually, and got tenure, found out last April. So, it's evolved and changed quite a bit as a visiting instructor. Back in those first 4 years, I was teaching a lot. So I was not only teaching the technology courses and introducing some new courses there, I was also actually teaching composition. We had lost a faculty member that was teaching technology and composition. So I was getting hired as he was leaving, and they decided to, put me to work. I wasn't going to say no to anything at the time. So I was pretty excited about it. And I studied composition for 3 years as an undergrad with Stella Sung, and who is still on faculty at UCF. So I had that background and had composed a lot as an undergrad. Took about 5 years off from doing a lot of composing. I'd done some soundtracks and whatnot at that time, but was really just focused on playing. And so coming back to UCF, it really meant a lot to move into technology and the composition, in addition to running the percussion studio and doing all of that. Jeff Moore still teaches. Kirk Gay, of course, is on faculty as well. So we're a team of three in the percussion area. We all have our hands busy elsewhere too.
Well, it sounds like a story that's a perfect testament of encouraging students to be well-rounded, because in your case, I'm sure it helped you a lot that you were able to say, sure, I'll teach this. Yes, I'll teach this. What else? And just be able to adapt to the needs that the school had.
Yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, you know, we talk about being well-rounded percussionists, but just being ready for anything. Yeah, never thought I would be teaching either of these areas, and ended up teaching, I wasn't doing applied composition lessons. We had an adjunct composer doing that. And I was teaching a lecture composition course, Composition 1 and Composition 2, which were the beginnings of moving into the composition degree track. Yeah, just never thought I'd be doing that, but relied on so many people to help me get started, and was just so interested in doing it. And of course, working with composers is such an important thing for all of us, that having a chance to do that in the classroom was really great for me.
Speaking of working with composers, one of my favorite pieces I've ever done with a percussion ensemble is Zach Browning's Flying Tones.
Oh, which, yeah.
I'm very proud of my students recording that on YouTube. And when I did the piece, Zach told me the xylophone part was written for Thad Anderson, so it's really hard. So give that to your strong player.
That's not the hardest Zach Browning piece I've played.
But yeah, tell me, I went to the University of Illinois, so I got to know Zach there. Oh. I've had him as a guest composer a couple times, and we had him actually on the podcast, and the guy's an absolute riot. So much fun to be around and to work with. But could you tell us about your experience working with Zach on that piece, and it sounds like maybe on other pieces?
Yeah, I've done a number of things. Actually, I visited Illinois. We played at Smith. Hall. Is it Smith Hall?
Smith Memorial Hall. Yeah.
Smith Memorial Hall. And we did one of Zach's pieces there, a piece for two pianos, two percussion. What is that called? Venus something.
Venus Notorious, yeah.
Yes, that's right. Great piece. I love that piece. I played the drum set part. That has a nasty xylophone part as well.
who played the other part with you?
Maria Kearney.
Okay, I know. Yeah,
this was a Florida quartet from different universities here in Central Florida, and we did Zach had set up a tour for us in Illinois and Indiana, but yeah, how did I get introduced to Zach? I can't remember. This was way back. This is almost 10 years ago now, because he actually wrote Flying Tones as a dedication piece for our new Performing Arts Center, and we premiered it on campus at a big day that was a sort of a festival for the opening of this new building.
Was that when you were a faculty or student?
No, that was when I was faculty.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so this is like 2011 maybe? 2010, I think. Gotcha. Fall 2010. There's a video up, I think, of us playing it outdoors.
Very windy, I think. Yeah.
Yes, extremely windy. There may have been music stands flying across the stage. I've really always enjoyed working with Zach. I really like his music, and that was a fun project to work on. I know my students saw those cymbal parts, and they were just totally unsure of what to, you know. That's a piece I need to get back to. I'd love to program it again.
Yeah, it's one of those pieces where once you do that, anything with mixed meter will never throw anyone in that group ever again.
Oh yeah, yep. That is Zach.
Well, Thad, I think you had an album released recently that I want to make sure we talk about, called Lines and Spaces, and I checked it out. It's very, very cool. I want to read a little bit of the album notes on the website. It says the 15 tracks on Thad Anderson's Lines and Spaces are from his line series based on his compositional technique called duration lines that create both structure and polyrhythmic interest. And I'm wondering, can you tell us a little bit more about what is the technique of duration lines mean?
I always struggle with describing this. It's so simple too. It's so simple. And it's not that I created it either. I think, you know, just the way I've used the idea of essentially what's happening is, and the first track on the album is a good example of it. It's a quartet for tuned pipes. And, it was the first piece I really wrote in this style, which is a single rhythmic duration value, dotted quarter note or eighth notes or quarter notes, will fill up the entire bar. And those will then become layered. And so you'll hear, you might hear six quarter notes over four dotted quarter notes, for example. But taking this grid, it's easier to kind of show this grid taking different patterns from within that to develop rhythm ideas and counterpoint ideas. We had done David Lang's so-called Laws of Nature, and the second movement requires the six or seven tuned pipes. So I ended up taking four of those tuned pipes and composing for them with this very simple rhythmic idea, these duration lines. And it became this, I don't know, it just kind of, that was a piece I wrote really quickly. It just came to me as something I really enjoyed. And then I got to hear it in person and I really enjoyed it even more. And so I just kept kind of composing in that way. I haven't written a lines piece in a while now, but it's something, yeah, that did take up a good 6, 7, 8 years of my life. So,
as someone who's so hip to recording and technology, do you find that your knowledge of like production and recording affects how you compose? I know that as I do projects, I can't help be influenced by like how I will record this, like immediately affects me now, whereas it used to not. It used to be more in like the dream world and, you know, my most fantasy idea of a piece or whatever. But I don't know, is that similar for you?
Oh, that's a great question. And I would say early on with these particular set of pieces, not as much, but definitely with the later. There's a snare drum and electronics piece. There's a piece that was written for Bill Ryan's group, Grand Valley State. They did a national parks tour. It has a national parks quotes in it. It's another pipes piece that is non-percussionist played. I think with a lot of those pieces, not just the recording aspect of it and how is this going to transfer to an album, but also, you know, how can I take this to YouTube? How can I take this to the visual element to this and make a great, this day and age, putting something out on YouTube is maybe more significant than releasing an album, having something substantial to be able to do that is huge. And so I think I experienced the transition to some degree as I wrote these pieces. I actually never thought I would release an album of them but I got an opportunity and I had most of them already recorded, so was able to got a grant together and put the money together and was able to put it on release it. So
can you we've talked about this before, but I'd love to hear your expert opinion on this. You mentioned YouTube, having a good recording on YouTube is arguably better than having it on a CD. For maybe some of our especially younger listeners who maybe don't remember going to Gray Whale CD Exchange and, you know, trading in CDs, and yeah, it was like such a happy time in my life. Like they maybe didn't have that experience. I know. Can you explain what you mean a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, and I am by no means a YouTube sensation. I've really there's that's something I would like to become better with and video production. I'm not a video editor. I would need to rely on somebody else's chops to do that, really. But I see it, and I can give a prospective student one of our UCF percussion albums, and they'll look at it, and it will probably stay in the shrink wrap, because they can just, of course, get right on YouTube and Spotify or Apple Music or wherever they're going to stream their music and listen to it there. But of course, you know, the visual element of a YouTube release or a Vimeo release or whatever, and having that, the ability, Casey, with all of your music, I mean, the visual element of that, of seeing you perform and seeing your music performed is such a big part of the music itself. So I think that's a really important step for not just to realize for self-promotion or for getting your stuff out there, but just I think it's an important step in the direction of music in general. And it's been a good thing. I mean, I miss my record shops, and I like having my physical disc, of course, which is great, but you know, it's really powerful to have that visual element and the YouTube outlet for sure.
I miss my record shops, and we had a great discussion with I guess it was Lee Howard Stevens about this exact thing. And it was you know, if you only have this one record and you had to keep listening and you couldn't just click to the next thing, well, you have to dive a little deeper into it. And you know, it's like, should your kid have, you know, 20 toys in front of them or just two or three? It's like, sure. Well, if they only have two or three, they have to continue to be creative with what Absolutely. Else this toy can do, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'm sure there's experts that can talk on that. Ben, I'm going to pass it to you since I steamrolled you in the chat there. Classic.
You know, I was just to add to this, I remember hearing Rebecca Kite talk about making an album, and it used to be you would get, you know, 100 or 1,000 copies made, and I think she said it was like way cheaper to get 1,000 copies made when it came down to the per copy cost. And then you would hang on to the stack forever, and you would slowly sell them, and once you reached a certain point, you had covered your costs, then after that you made profits. And I really don't think that anyone is making all that much money off of, or has ever made much money off of, avant-garde 20th century percussion music. But that being said, I think that YouTube is such a valuable tool for both the composers, like Casey's pieces, and also the universities that are putting them out. For example, FAD students have a great video of Jose Before John 5, which when I saw that video, A, made me want to play that piece, but B, I was like, if I was a high school student in Florida and I saw this, I would probably go to UCF over this one video alone. So I think that, yeah, releasing an album, yeah, I think it still carries some weight. But I think as far as the practicality of it, the YouTube route is way, way more useful and way cheaper for all of us.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bob McCormick said to me once, he said, like, recording a CD is really a really expensive business card. Nothing more.
and I mean, like, I remember, it's funny, like, I think all of us are old enough to remember when YouTube came out. And one of the first, actually two of the first people I saw play marimba other than myself on YouTube were Brian Calhoun and Casey. And I remember seeing Casey play and being like, is everyone like this out there? Like, is this just a sea of people that play like this? Which, thank God, that was not the case. But yeah, it was eye-opening for me.
Totally. Expense.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, and it's tricky when your students, because I really encourage my students to have a web presence also, but it is really, it can be very, I don't know what the right word is, but it can be very something when you see someone produce. No, it's not slimy.
I was going to say the self-promoters get slimy.
Oh, sure. But like, you know, forever, Nancy Zeltzman didn't have anything up on YouTube. And then she makes this, like, kick-ass duo with her clarinet buddy there.
Video. Yes, I know the one.
right. Yes. And you know, the amount of views on it are just so low. And it just, I don't know, it's almost like if you missed the internet wave, if you didn't catch it. And there's certain composers that, you know, we talk to younger people these days that they just don't know about because they didn't catch that wave, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, I think the wave is certainly a thing, and but you know, to some degree, I mean, the Jose Before John video, I have total credit to my students. Those four, Karen, Mitchell, Christian, and Joey, those guys, I did the audio, but they did everything else. And
is Ted not in that one?
Ted, that was before Ted.
I thought Ted was your favorite.
But Ted was not in there, no.
Oh, Ted. I retract my previous statement, Ted.
Ted, you kicked off the podcast now.
Ted should be an honorary member, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what were you saying, Ted?
Oh, no. I think there's always an opportunity to jump in there with something that's really well done and very well hyped. Good production value and good performance means a lot. And, you know, so jumping in there, but you're right. You know, as far as going viral and just getting in there, you know, Nancy, you know, one of the best marimbists of our generation. And, you know, yeah, but, and that is such a wonderful recording. I know the exact video you're talking about.
Right. Yeah, I guess there's something, I don't know if to add somewhere to the conversation, like reach of these digital things is not the same thing as depth of these things. Like, I think everyone is familiar with Nancy, who is really everyone who is serious in this field and has been in it for the long haul is probably familiar with that. But as far as, well, check out this guy's chops or whatever, you got to see this video. Yeah, it doesn't have that viral effect. But yet it probably doesn't need that, you know? So we have to, as we're encouraging people to do this, which is such a labor intensive task, I guess we have to somehow like add that to the language, you know?
Totally.
If I could just put out one little quick thing, that video everyone's referencing of Nancy Zeltzman, it's a piece called Bananagram by Sean Michalik. I'm not sure I think Carly knows him. But anyway,
I know him.
Yeah, anyway. I emailed Nancy a while back. I love that piece. And I emailed her and I said, can you please help put me in touch with the composer? I would love to perform this piece. And she was very kind to forward my email and I never heard back. So if that composer is out there, we would love your work. Please tell us how to get our hands on it.
Yeah, email Ben. Don't email the podcast. The podcast gets enough emails. Carly, do you want news or do you want to go on to something else?
Sure, let's do news.
You want to do news? Give that a little break. So we're releasing on Halloween, as you can tell. And a couple of cool things happened. Well, one really cool thing. So in 1947... a little piece you all know of called Toccata for Percussion Instruments by Carlos Chavez, is age 48, is performed for the first time in Mexico City. And I think we all are pretty familiar with this piece, and no fault out there if you're not familiar with it. But yeah, it's called Toccata, Carlos Chavez. It's one of our, you know, whenever they talk about the first percussion ensemble and the earliest percussion ensembles, they include this piece. You don't like it, Ben?
Casey, that wasn't supposed to be public.
No, that's good. That's fun. That's good. That's, we're supposed to have conversation.
It's just, yeah, it's just not my favorite piece. It's
not really my favorite piece.
For early percussion rep, I really like the Rítmicas by Amadeo Roldán.
Right. Cool. So let me tell you why you're all wrong and everything. So fun facts, John Cage approached Chavez during 1930s to write a piece for his touring percussion ensemble. And this was, so he wrote this piece, the Toccata, and it was never performed by Cage's group. And I bet y'all can guess why if you know the piece. As you know, Cage's group, they were very limited in what they were able to do with percussion techniques and particularly buzz rolls. So there's extensive buzz rolls throughout the first movement, really soft rolls and crescendos and things, and it's a really key part of the opening movement. So due to the buzz rolls, Cage's group didn't play it. Another fun fact, originally, as you know, a toccata is a fast, virtuosic composition. However, Chavez applied the word toccata in its original sense, using its root meaning tocar, which means to touch. So he used this to display the various touches an artist can give a performance rather than the different lyrical shades you can get from, say, percussion music. And something I know we talked about very recently was, I think, with Stuart Gerber, and I think also with Lee Stevens, was just the like kind of frustration we get when a composer doesn't know what to do next. So what do? They add 20 other instruments for you to haul to the stage, and they add 20 more colors and use the entire everything in the kitchen sink, as Stuart put it. And one more fun fact, the U.S. premiere was given by L.A. Philharmonic and conducted by Chavez himself. In the program note, Chavez wrote, "The Toccata was written as an experiment in orthodox percussion instruments, those that are used regularly in symphony orchestras, that is, avoiding the exotic and the picturesque. Therefore, it relies on its purely musical expression and formalistic structure." Take that, Ben.
I think I was trying to find this in my vast materials I have on my computer. I think Chavez wrote another piece that for percussion ensemble that he retracted, And like, I'm like maybe confusing him with someone else, but I know that Bill Mersch said that he got a hold of one of these rare pieces and performed it, then later on found out that the composer had retracted the piece.
I believe I bumped into them. There are these little two movements, and I didn't jot any of it down as it didn't pertain to anything that happened on October 31st.
But that was, yes, Chavez?
Thank you. Yeah, but Chavez, yeah. Yeah. I love, if y'all have ever played his Indian Symphony, that piece is really, really cool with a lot of great adventurous percussion. The percussion writing in that is just really, really fantastic. And one more thing happened today. This is not nearly as exciting as the previous, but in 2011, did you all know Metallica has something to do with an Alban Berg opera called Lulu? This is really disappointing. So an album called Lulu, which is this baffling collaboration between Metallica and Lou Reed, is released on Halloween. So this is not exactly the Lulu opera, but it is from the same play, the same root play that Alban Berg took his famous Lulu from. Lou Reed and Metallica collaborate on this just god-awful album. And I was going to play like some sound of it, and I couldn't even tolerate the 5 seconds to screen capture it. So I gave up, and it's just terrible, and it's embarrassing, and don't listen to it. So that came out too.
I feel like if that were on a quiz show, like which one of these things didn't actually happen, I would think that is something that could never have happened.
Well, right. Well, and I think it was Brian Nosny on one of these episodes. We got talking about music, as we often do off camera. And he said, oh, yeah, do you know that Metallica did this whole like Lulu thing? And I was like, what? No, they didn't. And then he showed it to me. And it's just awful. Like Lou Reed is reciting all this poetry as he does, which I think is fine. But like Metallica's just jamming behind it, and it clearly is just like the cheapest, easiest effort anyone ever. Oh, just, it's, yeah,
good to know.
It really important, it's Halloween, so yeah. On that note, the Metallica Lulu thing, I have one sound effect for it. You're waiting for this. There we go. Wasn't that worth the wait?
So worth it.
Totally worth it. Think you should do it again with the nose on, though. It's not as effective.
Someone have a question for Thad?
Sure, I do. Thad, I know that very recently you performed a concert with the Line Upon Line percussion group featuring works by John Cage, Xenakis, and Steve Reich. Sounds like a super great program. Have you collaborated with them before?
Yeah, we go way back. We were all in school together at Texas. So they formed as a trio in 2009. I think one of their first trips out of Austin was to come to UCF and do a concert during that inaugural season of theirs. But I've been out 3 or 4 times over the past 5 or 6 years to do various projects. We did drumming with a dance company in Austin. I was there in December where we did John Cage's City Wears a Slouch Hat, which is his radio play, which is, 6 percussionists. So it was Line Upon Line guys, the trio, Tom Burritt, John Lane, and I. And we did First Construction and what else did we do? So another, it was a Cage concert. So this was this was their opening concert of their season of their Austin series, and they decided to do like a happy birthday or a 10 year anniversary kind of show where they programmed we opened with Imaginary Landscape number 2, which is a piece that I wrote my lecture recital on. This is a piece that was originally titled Fourth Construction that he then retitled and threw away a piece and retitled Imaginary Landscape number 2. So we did that. We did 2 movements from Pleiades, Xenakis. We did Matteau. They have a set of 6-in. And we did Poe. And then we reset and did Sextet, Reich's Sextet. So, yeah, it was a lot of work, but it was fun.
So Thad, since you mentioned Tom Burritt, I was kind of doing the math. I think Tom Burritt started at UT in 2001, and you graduated around 2006 with your master's, which means you were one of his first students. And Carly and I had the similar experience, and we were two of Svet's first students at Miami.
Right.
What was it that drew you to him? Because obviously with a new professor, there's no track record.
Right. No, totally. Yeah. So I started at Texas in 2004. So he had, I think he was going into his fourth year that year. And of course, did my master's finished my master's in 06 and then my doctorate in 09. So I was there for 5 years with Tom and it was great. I loved it. But I had worked with him at the Northwestern Keyboard Seminar one summer. And that's how I got to know him, and did my 4 or 5 auditions, and ended up really liking Texas and Austin, and of course Tom. So that's how I ended up there.
Were you his favorite student?
I was his favorite student. Still I am. Nice.
I think Ted should get a credit in
right.
the title. This episode is turning to be about Ted.
Yeah. But I'm glad Ted could take it over. I won't give it away. I'll let Ted just like discover it on his own.
Sure. Carly, do you have a topic for the day?
I do, yeah. So I recently got to play a concert with the Miami Sousa Band, which is a relatively new ensemble in Miami that's following many of the traditions of the original John Philip Sousa Band. So it was cool for one thing, because actually as professionals, we don't get to play with professional wind ensembles or bands very often, just something I totally didn't realize when I was in school. But also really cool to learn about some of the traditions of the Sousa Band and kind of how does this work for us, especially as percussionists. So the repertoire was chosen from the Sousa Band tradition, which is, of course, a lot of Sousa marches, along with some orchestral transcriptions. Like in this concert, we played an arrangement of 1812 Overture and the Overture from Nabucco. And we also followed the tradition of pacing throughout the concert, which means there's about 8 to 10 seconds in between each piece. So it's like, boom, right on to the next thing, which, of course, is like presenting some challenges for the percussion section if you have to change instruments or move or anything. But the momentum and energy that these quick transitions give to the program, like, is really exciting. There's no downtime. There's no time for anybody to think about anything else. And it just feels really lively. But of course, we had to plan the part assignments very carefully. We wanted to move as little as possible, but we did allow for some switching between cymbals and bass drum or other accessories. One, so that the cymbal player isn't dead at the end of the night. And two, because some different pieces have, like, you know, one piece might have tambourine or bells and xylophone, just different instrumentation. Although, according to my research, both the original Sousa Band and Keith Bryan's new Sousa Band normally just have one player always playing bass drum with cymbal attachment for the whole concert. But we only did cymbal attachment when we needed to, because we needed more players for some of the repertoire. So for pieces with different instrumentation, like mallet parts or accessories, of course, there's some moving around. But the percussion section was strategic about the setup and who would play what to keep things as compact as possible. So in preparing for this concert, I was doing some research on how to approach some of these challenges. And I wanted to share just a few of the most interesting bits with you all. And one of the topics that I got really caught up reading about with regards to performance practice and percussion in Sousa marches is the elusive Sousa accent. Has anyone ever been playing a Sousa march and you get a cue for like a big accent on bass drum or cymbals and it's not in the music?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen it happen. And then on top of that, there's all these different versions and arrangements and everything. So in my research, I found a funny quote about this exact scenario. It's from a 1955 letter from Carl King, who was like a circus band conductor. It's a letter to C.L. Barnhouse of like Barnhouse Publishing Company. And he wrote, again, this is 1955. He said, "Bass drummers have been my pet peeve for years. And Henry Fillmore says the same thing. Whenever we go to guest conduct, we suffer from dumb bass drummers We swing out for an accent and nothing happens. The guy just looks at us with a dumb expression as if to say, what does the man want? And I have to say, the first time that I read this, I thought it said, we suffer from dumbass drummers.
isn't that basically what was said? I mean, bass drummers?
Basically the same thing. So I thought that was funny. Brian Holt, who plays with Keith Bryan's new Sousa band, which is like another, you know, a really established Sousa band that follows the tradition of the old Sousa band. He wrote an article titled Bass Drum and Attached Cymbal Playing as Employed in Concert Bands of the Sousa Era and the Modern Concert Band. It's got a lot of great information, and you can find it if you're interested on newsousaband.com. Or really, if you just Google Sousa percussion, you're going to find a couple articles by Brian Holt. And he talks about these accents, and he says they may be improvised at the discretion of the player or music director. And he gives some guidelines on how to decide when you want to play these accents. The first guideline is that natural accents occurring in the melodic line are played for emphasis at the relative dynamic level. He says musical climaxes or unusual chord changes are accented with a full, deep sound. These are most effective if played very slightly late and will add depth to the ensemble sound. The third one is solo accents exceed the volume of the band. And the fourth I thought was really interesting. He said accents may be played on an open beat to set up a melodic phrase. Jazz drummers would refer to this as kicking the band. Let the bass drum ring to the next beat on most accents, with the exception of staccato accents. Cymbals may ring through several beats. Listen to the trumpets for duration of cymbal crashes. And it is a nice effect to sometimes play accents in the melodic style with cymbals on higher pitches and bass drum on lower pitches. Mm-hmm. So just to think about, like, all of this experience when you're playing in that style all the time, and kind of there's so much that's not written down, or that, you know, even sometimes in these parts are written down differently or maybe wrong. There was one other article that I found titled In Search of Tradition, John Philip Sousa. It's written by Captain Frank Byrne, who was the chief librarian and tuba player of the U.S. Marine Band, and he personally edited a lot of the Sousa marches. And Byrne talks about how these accents were almost never written down, and he speculates that it was because Sousa wanted his band to be the only group that plays in that specific style with those specific markings. So it's kind of like there's no substitute for the real Sousa band. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. A few other performance practice issues that relate to percussion in the performance of Sousa's music are things like bass drum and cymbals sometimes being tacit during piano sections, or, you know, like one time through the trio, first time you don't play. And also there's some really commonly played changes, like the roll-off that a lot of people play at the end of Stars and Stripes Forever. Do you guys play the roll-off instead of just keep going with the five-stroke rolls? Yeah, I think most people do it. But, you know, I think the way that I found out about it is I was playing the part and somebody said, hey, we're doing a roll off here. And that's just how it is. So some of these like unwritten things that people pass down. One other article I'll tell you about if you're interested in learning more about this is an article on the PAS website. It's called The Life and Music of John Joseph Henney. He was a Sousa band percussionist and xylophone soloist, like towards the end of the time that John Philip Sousa was working with the Sousa band. And then there are also a couple of articles, like that I mentioned, by Brian Holt, who's a percussionist in the new Sousa band. He wrote one on snare drum rolls and on the bass drum and cymbal playing. And I just think it's so cool because I've never really dug into any of this before. Like, we've all played plenty of Sousa marches, but usually it's like, you know, an encore or beginning of a concert or Pops concert, and haven't given as much thought to all the tradition behind it.
Wow, that's cool, Carly.
Yeah, I find the Sousa stuff fascinating because, like, there's so much music history of Europe, and it seems like we have, at times, it feels like we have so little of it in America, which is obviously not the case. But just a couple other things. One, when I was in Florida, I played with not the group that Carly was talking about, but a different professional wind band that did a Sousa concert recreation. And we played the finale from Tchaikovsky's Fourth, you know, arranged for wind band and so on. But one of the coolest things was that one of Sousa's xylophone soloists, in fact, probably the most famous one, was Joe Green, And so I got to meet Joe Green for that concert. I played Xylophonia with the band, which is pretty cool.
Then that was a quiz question for the day.
Oh, well, there you go.
I think I just have to give
you. Steamrolled you. And then this is not percussion related, but one other name that we hear quite a bit with trumpet players is Herbert Clark. You hear of Clark Studies, and Herbert Clark was the trumpet or cornet soloist for the Sousa band. And I had something else I was going to say. I was just going to say one other thing. I've heard that Sousa never performed the same thing twice. He liked the sort of spontaneity of it. The way that this
program.
What's
or
that?
The same piece or the same?
He would never perform the same piece twice. So today the trio is going to be played by the flutes and clarinets. And something else. So that would kind of reflect, I think, what Carly's talking about. And it makes sense that he would not want to, because if you know anything about their touring schedule, both when he was the conductor of the Marine Band and then the Sousa Band came after that, these people would play, just constantly, I think, 300 concerts a year plus, something like that. Just an insane amount from one city to the next with very little rehearsal time. It helped that he had the greatest virtuosos of the day, like Herbert Clark and Joe Green in his group. But very, very interesting stuff.
Well, those concerts are really demanding for all the wind and brass players, too. You know, for us, if you're playing cymbals, of course, that's like, that can be exhausting if you don't play cymbals for hours every day. But playing snare drum for a couple hours is no big deal.
In the Sousa stuff, all of a sudden the trumpet is playing the violin lines, and that's hard,
right?
Especially for an hour.
Is it a normal wind band setup, this group, Carly, that you just played with, or is it like
you mean like physical setup?
Yeah
Pretty standard.
Military band sort of.
I was going to say, it's cool what you were describing, Carly, and it just reminds me of a performance one of my students had in studio class that was a snare drum solo, and it was just great. It was really, really, really good, and we were all just kind of trying to figure out what was so good about it, and in my mind, it just simply had style. It's like he just played it with style, and like just had every nook and cranny of the piece figured out and ingrained and internalized so that it came off as style. And as a teacher, you have to say like, okay, how do you do that? How do you tell people to play with style? It's so hard. Like, it's so hard. You know, everything you described is specific stylistic things that happen in Sousa that aren't on the page. And I think we all know a lot of times those things are far, far more nuanced and difficult to achieve than, hey, you can do an accent when it's not written or something. Like, there's so much there, and it's just so, so hard to teach.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to talk about. Well, you know, there's no like prescriptive way of like, this is what you can do, and then you're going to sound like you know how to play in this style. You know, it's like you listen a lot. And that's one other thing I wanted to say is like, you can check out like the Marine Band recordings of this stuff. And if you find anything from the new Sousa Band, like, and listen and study, like, that's probably the best way. Otherwise, you know, you can't always play just what's on the part and have it sound like Casey, what you're saying, like the right style.
And that's the other weird thing. It's not even because you could play what's not on the page and people will hear that, but the people hearing it don't know what's on the page. So you could even do those quote stylistic things and still not have it come off with style. You know what I mean? Like, it might. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's a very mysterious thing. Ben, I think you have something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, have you guys ever noticed that Sousa has like a few marches named after newspapers, like the Washington Post March?
Yeah, I am.
What's up with that?
So my understanding is that when the group would go on tour, it was basically free advertising. If you had a march called the Washington Post March, then the Washington Post would publicize it. That's my understanding. Wow. I could be totally wrong, but it definitely makes sense for a touring group.
So Thad, we're talking a lot about composition and we just talked about Sousa so much. And I was just wondering, this is like, I guess, possibly a really huge question, but how do you like to teach composition? I find it can be very mysterious sometimes, and it can really vary drastically from student to student.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know that I've found the right way, or you know, that there is. I think, you know, for me, it's the interaction with that student. And we require that all of our percussion students are composing every semester too. So they have a composition project associated with their applied lesson. it starts out as smaller etudes for single instruments, and then it builds into percussion ensemble stuff, but they're composing for percussion instruments. And, you know, whether I'm working, I'm not working with the composition students so much anymore, but with the percussion students, or years ago with the composition majors, it was just that, you know, you sort of had to feel out what every student needs, not unlike an applied lesson with a percussion student. But, and yeah, I don't know. That is that's a tough question to answer. I'm certainly not an expert, and, you know, still learning myself. But I think it's that give and take and that feedback that really, we're going to premiere a brand new piece by a student composer this semester for mezzo soprano and percussion quartet. And we just went through another round of drafts and revisions, and we'll actually rehearse it tomorrow. You know, working with her on this piece has really reminded me of all of that, the interpersonal conversation that happens when developing a piece of music, and something that no one's ever heard before, including the performers, for the most part up to this point. So, my 2 cents.
Yeah, thanks.
Casey, I think you have a quiz for us.
Yeah, do y'all want to close out with your quiz? Thad, we do a little quiz on the show. I get this metronome here going. Makes it feel like you're on a game show.
That's perfect.
Do you feel like you're on a game show?
I do.
Every guest I've asked that always says I do. They're very polite. Yeah, we're very... I think we have everyone's very polite. Nobody has said, what? That's stupid. No, I don't feel like I'm on a game.
No, I don't.
No, everyone, it's just, we work in a very friendly place. So I had to bail on a question because Ben gave it away. But regarding the same topic, in 1923, the three Green brothers, George, Joe, and Lou, contributed sound effects to a silent movie by Alfred Hitchcock. What was this movie titled? I expect Ben to remember.
Wait, 1923 movie by Hitchcock?
Yeah, it was. You reported.
Oh, I was just thinking of Steamboat Willie, the Disney movie. I didn't.
That's in there, but there's another movie they did sound effects for.
Oh, I forgot then.
Okay, at least according to you, it's called The White Shadow.
Huh.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, that's way back on episode 11. So that's like 4 years ago.
That title's like Hitchcock. Like that's just not ringing a bell at all.
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't have remembered either. I had to go back and dig through, and yeah, I was just listening to old episodes to dig out questions. So yeah, you can actually watch the whole movie on YouTube. I found some sound effects in there. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I was trying to find what might have been percussion sound effects, and I did find some claves towards the end. So anyway, the Green Brothers, and there are three of them: George, Joe, and the youngest is Lou, doing sound effects on there. So, okay. So no point awarded there. And here's another one. One of our icons passed away in December of 2018, an author of over 60 published articles, several compositions, and 13 books spanning from 1964 to 2006. Who was this?
What year was it?
It was 2008 that they passed away. Sorry, 2018. Excuse me.
I'm blanking. I was thinking like De La Cluse, but I don't think he wrote that much.
Oh, that's close. It was around that time. Vida Chenoweth.
Oh.
I think Ben reported on that too.
I know. Well, and also, Carly, this was on episode 171. Which, do you know whose episode that was?
That was my episode.
That's right. Yeah. No, those were tough. So that's your quiz for the day. And a third question, who is Thad's favorite student? That was Ben's idea. Ben put that in the chat. I think you should get a point
all
for that.
All of them.
So wait, Casey, could you say the Vida Chenoweth question again just so I can catch what the facts were one time?
Sure. One of our icons passed away in December of 2018. Author of over 60 published articles, several compositions, and 13 books spanning from 1964 to 2006.
Yeah, I think what got me is I can't think of any of her compositions.
Yeah, right. Well, and I didn't say anything about her playing or marimba or anything. Yeah. So that's that's the obvious clue. Yeah.
It's like a Halloween prank kind of quiz, Casey.
Tough quiz.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I couldn't find anything too Halloween-y in there other than the news and the awful Metallica collaboration. All right.
That's all?
that's all.
Yep. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap up. Thad, thank you so much for talking to us with us about so many different things and interesting projects you've done. It's great to have you on, and we'll see you all next time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Have a good
one. Shout out to Ted Jackson.
Yes.
Thanks, Thad.
Yeah. Have a good one.
All right. Happy Halloween, everyone.